Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 2.18, The Ilinden Uprising, The Macedonian Struggle, Part 3. On the morning of April 28th, 1903, a French commercial vessel was getting ready to leave the bustling Salonika harbor at just past 10 in the morning. It was a bright, sunny day in this Aegean port city of Macedonia, and the French consul who lived and worked in Salonika was present at the scene, surveying the dockyard, collecting inventory, and making sure that all necessary crew members were present. For this French consul, it seemed for all the world like that day would be just like any other routine day, with the only oddity he had so far noticed being a young Slavic man whom he did not recognize, and who had been watching the French ship with an unusual level of intensity. However, it was not that unusual to see such young vagrant Macedo-Bulgarians in the dockyards, so the consul quickly moved on to other tasks. Then, just as the French vessel was about to set sail, a huge explosion suddenly rocked the ship's engine room. And as fire quickly began to spread across the ship's deck, the French consul ran up to the ship in a panic, stopping by this young Macedo-Bulgarian to see what had happened. And as the French consul asked his secretary to explain what he had seen, the young man next to them simply listened and continued to calmly watch the aftermath of the explosion. After the crew had finally managed to control the fire, the ship's passengers began boarding lifeboats, and everyone would make it safely to the shore. Amongst the large crowd of onlookers who began pouring into the harbor, most assumed that the explosion had occurred due to an accidental fire in the engine room. However, after hearing reports from the ship's crew, the Ottoman authorities quickly began to realize that this explosion had been the result of a bomb. This bomb had been planted by the 21-year-old Macedo-Bulgarian present at the harbor. His name was Pavel Chetev, and he was a member of the anarchist revolutionary group known as the Boatmen. Later that very same day, another bomb would destroy the rail line connecting Salonika to Istanbul, derailing a passenger train in the process. Then, the following evening, complete darkness gripped the typically well-lit streets of Salonika as saboteurs began destroying the gas lines running into the city. And just as the residents of Salonika were trying to figure out why the city had suddenly gone completely dark, another massive explosion was heard from the European district as the Salonika branch of the Imperial Ottoman Bank had been blown to pieces. This explosion dwarfed those witnessed the previous day, and the bombs planted at the Ottoman Bank would flatten the surrounding buildings and lead to dozens of deaths, including many German expats. Then, in a gruesome grand finale, members of the Boatmen began to fan throughout Salonika's European district, indiscriminately throwing homemade bombs and Molotov cocktails into the local theaters, clubs, hotels, and cafes. As the Ottoman authorities descended into the area, these revolutionaries were chased into a local building where they began hurling bombs from the top balcony. Finally, the Ottoman gendarmerie managed to break their way into the besieged building, and after a brief shootout, all of the perpetrators were either killed or arrested. The 1903 bombing campaign in Salonika represented the moment when 20th century style anarchism truly made its entrance into Ottoman society. As we just mentioned, these bombings had been carried out by the organization known as the Boatmen, and the Boatmen were a Macedo-Bulgarian anarchist group founded in 1898 by young graduates of the Bulgarian Men's High School of Salonika. Now, you may remember from last week that Dom Gruev, Gota Delchev, and Boris Sarafov had also all graduated from the Bulgarian Men's High School. So, the Boatmen were, in this way, loosely associated with the MRO and the supremacists, though the Boatmen were a distinct group with a distinct ideology. The Boatmen originally formed as a secret brotherhood of Macedo-Bulgarian students studying in Geneva, Switzerland. Much like the Armenian parties also operating in Geneva, the Dashnaks and the Hunchaks, the Boatmen were heavily influenced by Russian anarchism, specifically following in the tradition of Mikhail Bakunin. and all of the original founders of the boatmen were former students of a Bulgarian teacher and revolutionary named Mikhail Gerzhikov. Before moving to Geneva and forming this cohort of anarchist disciples, Mikhail Gerzhikov had led a secret revolutionary committee in Plovdiv, the capital of the autonomous Eastern Rumelia, which had united with the Bulgarian Principality in 1885. This secret organization, led by Gerzhikov, was one of the very first Bulgarian societies to specifically center its ideology around anarchism. And then, when Gerzhikov moved to Geneva, he would build a community of revolutionaries who were all fiercely committed to using anarchist tactics to liberate Ottoman Macedonia and southern Thrace. This group surrounding Gerzhikov would become known as the Geneva Group, and it would form the nucleus of the boatmen, who would later put these anarchist tactics into practice when they carried out the 1903 Salonika bombing campaign. Within the Macedonian revolutionary movement, Mikhail Gerzhikov and his anarchist followers represented an alternative approach to the Macedonian question that was beginning to gain more and more traction moving into the 20th century, especially within the MRO. As we have noted, Gerzhikov was a committed anarchist, and the official slogan for both the Geneva Group and for the boatmen was the famous anarchist phrase, first popularized by French radical Auguste Blanqui, "No gods, no masters." And the group adopted their name, the Boatmen, to express their intention to, quote, "leave behind the everyday life and the limits of law, and sail with a boat into the free and wild seas of lawlessness." And then, along with being anarchist, many in the Geneva Group would also come to reject chauvinistic nationalism, not only coming out of Serbia and Greece, but also coming from their home territory in Bulgaria. So, even though Gerzhikov and his followers were all Bulgarians, they would begin to preach a new vision for the future of Macedonia, best encapsulated by the slogan, "Macedonia for the Macedonians." As we touched upon last week, this idea of Macedonia for the Macedonians was a self-conscious attempt to move past the rising tide of ethnic nationalism that was increasingly defining not only the Macedonian struggle, but also politics within the Balkans more generally. Because what we need to keep in mind is that at this point, there was not a well-defined Macedonian ethnic identity. So when people said Macedonia for the Macedonians, they were largely referring to a project which sought to build a multi-ethnic Balkan confederation, in which the rights of all the different ethnic groups of Macedonia and Thrace would be protected. And one way I have heard this described is as an attempt to essentially turn Macedonia into the Switzerland of the Balkans. And this group had long been based in Geneva, Switzerland, so you can kind of see where this might be coming from. But along with being inspired by the Swiss model of a multi-ethnic confederacy, these left-wing Macedonian revolutionaries were even more heavily inspired by the internationalism currently being promoted amongst socialists within the Second International. And for those of you familiar with the Russian Revolution, you'll know that this brand of international socialism would come to define the ideology of Vladimir Lenin, as Lenin would continue to push for international solidarity amongst all working people, even as other socialists began to profess their loyalty to their respective nations, when the world descended into chaos leading up to World War I. Lenin's push for international solidarity amongst all working people would come to define the ideology of the Bolsheviks and would be one of the biggest reasons why the Bolsheviks would grow their ranks, as Lenin promised to put an end to the increasingly unpopular war. So, like so many other things in World War I, this tension amongst left-wing radicals between loyalty to one's nation versus class solidarity across national and ethnic lines would play out in miniature in the Balkans about a decade before it would play out on a global scale in World War I. Okay, so anarchism and international socialism had begun to animate the activities of Macedonian revolutionaries more and more moving into the 20th century. And another sign of this shift towards left-wing internationalism is that in 1902, the MRO would open up its membership to non-Bulgarian members. And so the MRO would begin to have Serbian and Greek members, and they would even try to recruit Muslim Turks and Albanians, though they had very little success in this effort. And as we will see, these sorts of attempts to bring together the many ethnicities of Macedonia would always be extremely messy, and the MRO would never really be able to shed its Bulgarian character. But nonetheless, these left-wing ideas influenced by international socialism and anarchism had begun to swirl around, and they would heavily influence the future direction of the Macedonian revolutionary movement in the early 20th century. Now, certainly not all Macedonian revolutionaries were on board with these sorts of left-wing utopian projects to construct a supranational Balkan confederation. Because, as we touched upon last week, in addition to the MRO operating inside of Ottoman Macedonia, there was this other revolutionary group operating across the border in the Bulgarian principality known as the Supremacists. As a refresher, the Supremacists in the Bulgarian capital of Sofia were made up almost entirely of hyper-nationalist Bulgarian army officers. And these officers did not simply want to achieve autonomy for Macedonia, but instead they wanted to win autonomy specifically in order to prepare Macedonia to be annexed into the Bulgarian principality. And well, in recent years, members of the MRO had begun to cool on the idea of being annexed directly into Bulgaria, and they had begun to think that maybe Macedonia would be better off as a separate autonomous entity, especially as these chauvinistic officers began to look down upon Macedonian revolutionaries. Now, along with having these divergent end goals, the MRO and the Supremacists had also begun to promote opposing strategies for how best to achieve the liberation of Macedonia. Now, you may remember, the MRO, under the leadership of Goca Delchev, had spent the past several years aggressively building a network of revolutionary committees throughout Macedonia and southern Thrace. And this process would then accelerate after Jan Sandanski kidnapped the American Protestant missionary, Ellen Stone, and scored a huge ransom of $2.5 million for the MRO. So within Macedonia and southern Thrace, the reach of the MRO had grown considerably, and MRO committee leaders had begun recruiting peasants and had begun stockpiling weapons, ammunition, and bombs in preparation for a mass uprising. Now, at this point in the early 1900s, the MRO felt that this mass uprising was still years in the future, because even though they did have some serious momentum, the MRO still needed to stockpile more weapons and to recruit and train more members if they were ever going to be able to face off against the powerful Ottoman army. The officers in the Supremacists fundamentally disagreed with this more patient approach, and thought that the best way to achieve liberation for Macedonia was not to wait until the Macedonian peasantry was ready to launch a mass uprising, but instead they wanted to precipitate a war between the Principality of Bulgaria and the Ottoman Empire. And last week we left the Supremacists as their organization was being taken over by a high-ranking Bulgarian general. This general was named Ivan Sonchev. General Sonchev was an arrogant and chauvinistic Bulgarian officer who looked down upon the revolutionaries in the MRO because they were not military men. Sonchev basically thought that the MRO should be completely subservient to the officers in the Supremacists, and that they should only work to support the Bulgarian army in a future war to liberate Macedonia. The leaders of the MRO, specifically Goca Delchev and Jan Sandanski, argued strongly against such a war, pointing to the recent conflict between the Greeks and the Ottomans in which the newly modernized military of the Ottomans had completely trounced the Greek army. And this defeat had been devastating for the Greek nation and had seriously weakened the Greek position in Macedonia. And then, along with making the argument that the Bulgarians would likely lose any war against the Ottomans, Delchev, Sandanski, and other MRO leaders operating on the ground inside of Ottoman Macedonia also had a keen awareness that they were nowhere near ready for a mass uprising. And well, the Supremacists didn't care about this fact because they didn't think that a mass uprising would be necessary if the Bulgarian army just invaded Macedonia. And this really gets us to the major divide emerging amongst Macedonian revolutionaries, best illustrated by this growing rivalry between the MRO and the supremacists. Increasingly influenced by populist left-wing ideologies like socialism and anarchism, the MRO had begun to put all of their efforts towards laying the groundwork for a true mass uprising in which the peasants of Macedonia would rise up en masse and drive the Ottomans out, winning their liberation on their own behalf. And well, this approach lay in stark contrast to the supremacists who essentially just wanted to invade Ottoman Macedonia on behalf of the Bulgarian state. Delchev and Sandanski loudly denounced this approach as they rightly feared that a premature uprising would not only fail to win Macedonian autonomy, but such an uprising would also undo all of the MRO's hard work over the past several years, in which they were trying to lay the groundwork for a true peasant-led uprising. So, Delchev and his followers would constantly urge General Sonchev and the supremacists to exercise patience in launching their revolt. Liberation would come, but first, the peasantry needed to be brought over to the revolutionary cause. Peasants were not going to just magically join up with a bunch of crazy, suicidal revolutionaries whom they had never met, just because those revolutionaries began launching attacks against the Ottomans. The loyalty of these peasants needed to be gradually cultivated through providing real material support for Macedonian communities. So, Delchev and others in the MRO would argue that if the groundwork for a true mass uprising was not properly laid through education and network building, then the only result of a premature uprising would be utter devastation for the Christians of Macedonia, as the Ottomans were sure to unleash a terrible campaign of retribution against the peasantry. Even with these warnings, the hyper-nationalist General Sonchev had fully taken control of the supremacists in 1902, and he had begun to turn all of their efforts towards preparing for an immediate Cheta invasion into Macedonia. Now, because the organization was made up of Bulgarian officers, the supremacists had long exercised control over the flow of weapons and ammunition coming out of Bulgaria. So the supremacists began to use this to their advantage as they sent agents into Macedonia and began promising town leaders access to weapons in exchange for joining up with their cause. This would be a major blow to the MRO, who began to lose towns to the supremacists, and with this little bit of momentum, General Sonchev would decide to take his shot, and he would lead a Cheta band across the Ottoman border in late September of 1902. And in so doing, he would launch what would come to be called the Gornja-Jumaya Uprising. As I have alluded to, this uprising would be yet another absolute catastrophe in nearly every regard. Now, when General Sonchev and his guerrilla bands entered Macedonia, they were able to muster close to 3,000 fighters, which included soldiers from the Bulgarian military as well as local rebels drawn from the Macedonian peasantry. However, even though this was a bigger force than the 800 irregulars mustered for the earlier 1895 invasion, these 3,000 largely untrained and ill-equipped guerrillas would be facing off against an Ottoman force of close to 14,000 well-trained and well-equipped troops. So, General Sonchev's little adventure never had any chance of succeeding. But all evidence seems to point to the fact that Sonchev knew that the uprising would likely fail going into it. Remember, General Sonchev was trying to precipitate a war between Bulgaria and the Ottoman Empire, and he even reserved hope that the Russians would swoop in and declare war on the Ottomans as well, liberating Macedonia in the process. But in this belief, General Sonchev and the rest of the officers in the supremacists demonstrated their complete ignorance of the current realities of geopolitics. Because at this point in 1902, the Russians were currently preoccupied with their Far East adventure in Manchuria, an adventure that we will be coming back to because the Russo-Japanese War will have some very important ramifications for the project of the Young Turks. But this war was still a year and a half in the future, and as of now, the Russians were aggressively expanding into Manchuria.
What this meant is that the Russians wanted to maintain the status quo in the Balkans at all costs, and they were never going to support a war of aggression against the Ottoman Empire. So when the supremacists invaded Ottoman Macedonia, the Russians did not join them, but instead reprimanded the Bulgarian government in Sofia, just as they had done in 1895 after the first failed supremacist invasion, telling Bulgarian officials that they needed to figure out how to control these Macedonian cowboys who were constantly stirring up trouble. And so, now in a precarious diplomatic situation, the Bulgarians in Sofia would also not join this war, because they were completely isolated now. And they knew, just as Gotze Delchev had said, that Bulgaria would almost certainly lose any war against the Ottomans if they had to fight this war alone. So, neither the Russians nor the Bulgarians would intervene after General Sonchev's little adventure. And as Sonchev and his fellow officers scurried back across the border, just like they had in 1895, everyday Macedonians were yet again left to face the terrible retribution of the Ottoman authorities and the Bashi Bazouks as indiscriminate massacres were initiated against Christian peasants. General Sonchev's ill-fated Gorna Jumaya uprising would be perhaps most disastrous for the MRO agents working within Macedonia, who had been busy slowly educating the peasantry and gradually building up a revolutionary network. And when Sonchev and his fellow officers crossed the Ottoman border, they actually would be attacked by MRO guerrillas, including one raid initiated by Jan Sandanski. The left wing of the MRO, led by Gotze Delchev and Jan Sandanski, had been the most vocal opponents of a premature uprising, because they knew that such an uprising would be devastating for their overall project. The MRO had been working tirelessly to lay the groundwork for a true mass uprising that could both be led by the Macedonian peasants themselves and be large enough to actually have a chance of driving the Ottomans out once and for all. But after General Sonchev's premature uprising, the Ottomans would not only unleash the Bashi Bazouks on the Christian peasantry, but they would also use the uprisings as an excuse to begin arresting anyone vaguely suspected of being a member of the MRO, and the gendarmerie also began to more aggressively track down MRO guerrillas operating out in the countryside. And it would be within this context that tragedy would strike the MRO in May of 1903. Earlier that year, the MRO's greatest leader, Gotze Delchev, had traveled throughout Macedonia and Thrace, essentially doing damage control after Sonchev's failed uprising, as Delchev visited local committees and urged their leaders to please be patient and to continue stockpiling weapons and training peasants in preparation for the real uprising, which was not yet at hand. However, as a result of the general crackdown on MRO activities, many of the members of the MRO's central committee in Salonika had been arrested, and this would alter the leadership of the organization at a very critical moment. The new central committee would include Delchev's old classmate Boris Sarafov, who always held kind of a tweener position between the MRO and the supremacists. And well, Sarafov and the others in this new central committee would begin to send out memos to the local MRO branches, essentially saying that the supremacists had forced their hand and that an uprising needed to be launched immediately if the organization was going to survive. These memos sent Delchev into a frenzied panic, and he hurried down to Salonika to try and influence this decision of the Central Committee. But one thing that we need to understand about Delchev is that he was never a very good politician. Delchev was much more of an inspirational, and you might even call it spiritual, leader. And any time that real division opened up between Macedo-Bulgarians, Delchev was not great at navigating it. So, Delchev was unable to sway the Central Committee to change their course, and the MRO began committing itself to going ahead with their long-awaited uprising, even though leaders like Delchev and Sandanski believed that this uprising would be extremely premature. So, after failing to convince his old friend Sarafov and others in the Central Committee to change course, Delchev would depart Salonika, leaving the city just before the boatmen unleashed their bombing campaign and blew up the Salonika branch of the Ottoman bank. The attacks of the boatmen simply led the Ottoman authorities to further intensify their crackdown on MRO activities in Macedonia, and the Ottoman gendarmerie began to fan out across the countryside in order to track down the Macedonian guerrilla bands. And in early May 1903, Gotza Delchev was on his way to meet back up with Jan Sandanski to relay the message that the uprising was moving forward and to discuss how they should proceed. But while en route, Delchev's position was betrayed, likely by a local villager, and his guerrilla band would be suddenly surrounded by Ottoman soldiers. And when the guerrillas attempted to break through the Ottoman lines, Delchev would be shot in the chest, and he would tragically die. The death of Gotza Delchev, by far the most unifying figure in the MRO, would scatter the organization even more and would leave the Macedonian revolutionaries without their greatest leader at a time when they needed decisive leadership more than ever. The news of Delchev's death would reach Jan Sandanski just as he was also receiving word that the MRO was moving forward with their mass uprising. All of this was devastating for Sandanski, as Sandanski was perhaps the leader most opposed to a premature uprising, and he had also become very close with Gotza Delchev over the past few years. But realizing that he could do nothing to reverse course, Sandanski would begin to prepare his local committee in central Macedonia for their long-awaited uprising.
On the night of August the 2nd, 1903, the residents of the city of Monastir, the second largest city in Ottoman Macedonia and today known as Bitola, began to see fires popping out on the horizon. And though still distant, these fires illuminating the night sky were an omen that the revolutionary chaos of the Macedonian countryside was now closing in on Monastir and would soon reach the city, just as it had reached Salonika a few months earlier with the bombing campaign of the boatmen. Because throughout the surrounding region, Christian peasants had begun setting their hay bales ablaze as a signal that their long-awaited uprising was finally at hand. And MRO committee leaders scattered all throughout the towns and villages of the Monastir province began to see these little fires, and with this signal, they all began to dig, uncovering their weapons and ammunition and bombs, which they had buried years ago in preparation for this day. The Ilinden Uprising had begun. The first major battle of the Ilinden Uprising would be fought in the town of Krushevo. Lying to the north of Monastir and nestled high in the rugged mountains of Macedonia, Krushevo is still one of the highest towns in all of the Balkans at an elevation of close to 4,500 feet or around 1,400 meters. Though primarily populated by Christian peasants, Krushevo, like many other Macedonian towns, was quite diverse, ethnically, linguistically, and religiously, with large populations of Macedo-Bulgarians, Vlachs, and Albanians, who are almost all Orthodox Christians, either professing loyalty to the Greek Patriarchate or the Bulgarian Exarchate. Moving into the 1900s, Krushevo had emerged as a local center of left-wing politics, primarily through the leadership of a young teacher named Nikola Karev. Karev had grown up in Krushevo, but he moved to Sofia as a teenager to find work. While working in Sofia as a carpenter's apprentice, Karev became involved in the same community of left-wing radicals that Gotza Delchev was also involved in around this same time. And though Delchev was several years older, Nikola Karev would, like Delchev, become friends with the leader of the Social Democratic Workers' Party. Then Karev would move back to Macedonia and finish his education at a Bulgarian high school in Monastir. And upon graduating, he would return to his home in Krushevo to work as a teacher. Through his connections to left-wing Bulgarian politics, Nikola Karev would put together a small conference of Macedonian socialists in 1900. This conference would be held just outside of Krushevo, and during the Congress, the delegates mapped out a potential future for Macedonia, in which Macedonia was to become a socialist republic, and this republic was meant to act as the core element of a new Balkan confederation.
this hypothetical Macedonian Republic promised the rights of all the ethnic groups of Macedonia under the slogan Macedonia for the Macedonians. Following this conference, Nikola Karev and the other socialist delegates decided to merge their group with the MRO. And so Karev would become the leader of the MRO committee stationed in Krushevo. Leading up to the Ilinden Uprising, Karev did what all the other local MRO committee leaders did, as he stockpiled weapons, recruited members and educated peasants, and trained them in armed combat. And then, on August the 2nd, 1903, when Karev began to see beacons out on the horizon, he began to dig up his stockpiled weapons, and he mustered his Cheta guerrilla band and readied them to fight. That night, around 800 guerrillas under Karev's leadership would attack the military garrison near Krushevo and successfully take over the remote mountain town. The very next day, Nikola Karev would boldly proclaim the Krushevo Republic as the MRO leader put together a small democratic council with members representing all the different Christian ethnic groups of the town. Karev would also publish an official appeal to local Muslims, inviting them to join in on their revolutionary movement and asking for their help in driving the Ottoman authorities out of Macedonia. After Karev and his guerrilla band took Krushevo, word quickly began to spread that the uprising was now at hand, and so MRO leaders throughout the Monastir province began attacking Ottoman garrisons, sabotaging military infrastructure and taking towns and villages and declaring them for the MRO. And because Gotsadelchev, Jan Sandanski, Dam Gruev, and other MRO leaders had been tirelessly working to set up local revolutionary committees over the past several years, once local leaders began getting word that the uprising they had been waiting for had now truly come, the revolt would spread like wildfire. And within just a few weeks, MRO agents and Christian peasants following their lead would rise up across nearly the entire territory of Macedonia and southern Thrace, with uprisings breaking out as far west as the border of modern Albania and as far east as the city of Edirne, which lays just about 150 miles from Istanbul. And according to some figures, this uprising would eventually include some 25,000 MRO fighters alongside their peasant followers. And even though Gotsadelchev had sadly not lived to see this day, his disciple, Jan Sandanski, would himself eventually decide that the momentum was now unstoppable, and Sandanski would gather his guerrilla band and lead them against Ottoman garrisons in central Macedonia. On the far eastern edge of the uprising, all the way over in the Black Sea region of southeastern Thrace, yet another experiment in radical politics would be attempted amidst the chaos of the Ilinden Uprising. In early 1903, the MRO Committee of the Stranja region, a mountainous zone lying just to the east of the city of Edirne and around 100 miles up the Black Sea coast from Istanbul, had been put under the leadership of Mikhail Gerzhikov, who we talked about earlier in this episode as the anarchist leader of the Geneva Group and former teacher of the students who founded the Boatmen. And so when Gerzhikov received word that the MRO and their peasant followers had begun to rise up, Gerzhikov would quickly put together a revolutionary army. And in late August, Gerzhikov's army began attacking military garrisons, taking over government buildings, cutting telegraph lines, and sabotaging local infrastructure. Within a few weeks, the entire region of the Stranja Mountains had been taken over by MRO forces as the Ottoman gendarmerie and local Muslims began fleeing the area, most of them departing by boat from the local ports. At the height of the uprising, the MRO rebels managed to take control of around 100 towns and villages. All of these towns and villages were primarily populated by Orthodox Christians and were either controlled by the Bulgarian Exarchate or the Greek Patriarchate. Under Gerzhikov's leadership, this area of the Stranja Mountains would be briefly organized into a decentralized anarchist commune. And essentially, local towns and villages began to self-organize their own militias, and a commission was established in which towns began voluntarily cooperating with each other, organizing food rations, distributing arms, and reconstructing the local infrastructure. This little anarchist experiment is often called the Stranja Commune,
and the commune's leaders self-consciously resisted hierarchical structures and went out of their way to avoid coercing anyone to participate in their political project. And so, for a brief period, a little anarchist utopia spontaneously and organically arose in the Stranja Mountains, representing one of the earliest experiments in anarchist organizing, predating later and more famous events like Nestor Makhno's anarchist commune in southeastern Ukraine during the Russian Revolution, and the experiments in anarcho-syndicalism during the Spanish Civil War. The Krushevo Republic and the Stranja Commune were a clear expression of the radical left-wing movement within the MRO, first initiated by Gotsadelchev and then carried on by leaders such as Nikola Karev, Mikhail Gerzhikov, and Jan Sandanski. The Krushevo Republic expressed the dream of building a multi-ethnic Balkan confederation, in which socialist international solidarity would unite the population of Macedonia and do away with the division created by chauvinistic ethno-nationalism. The Stranja Commune went a step further and expressed the dream of ridding the Balkans of all oppressive hierarchies, and allowing the peasants to lead themselves within a decentralized and mostly voluntary system based around communitarian brotherhood. But even though these dreamy utopias would spontaneously come into being during the initial heady days of the Ilinden Uprising, when the MRO still enjoyed the element of surprise in facing off against the Ottoman authorities, by the end of autumn in 1903, the Ottomans had reorganized their forces and would aggressively attack all of the MRO strongholds throughout Macedonia and Thrace. And in part because MRO leaders had decided to spend their time organizing newfangled radical political systems, they had left their defenses quite vulnerable to attack. But even if the MRO rebels had put more of their focus on solidifying their gains and building defenses, the sheer reality of the numbers meant that the rebels were never going to be able to hold out for more than a few months. Because in the end, the Ottoman military would muster a total force that some sources put at over 350,000 troops. And so, even though the MRO had constructed a pretty impressive mass uprising, their 25,000 poorly armed and poorly trained irregular guerrillas basically had zero chance against the might of the newly modernized Ottoman military. And so, the warnings of Gotsadelchev and Jan Sandanski were proven to be correct, and the Ilinden Uprising was ultimately premature. And unlike the April Uprising, which had earned Bulgaria its autonomy some 25 years earlier, the Ilinden Uprising would not prompt any foreign military intervention, as the Russians were busy in Manchuria and the Bulgarians were diplomatically isolated, and would surely lose a war against the Ottomans as they would have to fight completely alone. So, after the elation of early victory and the brief establishment of these heady experimental political systems, the wrath of Ottoman repression would be brought down on the Christian peasants of Macedonia like a sledgehammer. And the devastation would be immense, as hundreds of villages were completely burned to the ground, thousands of Christian civilians were indiscriminately massacred, women and children were kidnapped or subjected to terrible sexual violence and abuse, and nearly 100,000 people were left completely homeless. So, for everyday Macedonians, this would be yet another humanitarian disaster in the Ottoman Empire. By mid-October 1903, 3 months after the uprising had begun, MRO leaders came together to order a ceasefire, and they would begin sending out messages to local committee members ordering them to disband their forces. This would, of course, be a messy and gradual process. But by the end of October, the Ilinden Uprising was over, and the MRO rebels had been completely crushed. The ultimate legacy of this uprising in Macedonia and southern Thrace would be varied and quite mixed. For the MRO, the Ilinden Uprising would represent the apex of their power and influence, and the organization would be permanently disrupted as the Ottoman authorities rooted out guerrilla bands operating in the countryside and arrested MRO leaders living in the cities of Salonika, Monastir, and Edirne. The party would also become split following the uprising, as fierce debates over what went wrong and how best to proceed emerged amongst those revolutionaries who managed to avoid arrest. This would come to be defined and understood as a split between the left wing of the MRO, which would be led by Jan Sandanski, and the right wing, led by revolutionaries associated with the supremacists. Because the Bulgarian government in Sofia would crack down on the supremacists after the Ilinden Uprising, and their committee would ultimately be dissolved. So many of the Bulgarian officers from the supremacists would thereafter join this right wing of the MRO. The left wing, under the leadership of Sandanski, would take up the mantle of Gotze Delchev and continue to argue that slow network building and education was the way forward, saying that the Ilinden Uprising had failed because it was launched prematurely and without enough planning or popular support. They would also adopt the left-wing vision of a Balkan confederation, in which Macedonia was to become a multi-ethnic republic under the Swiss model. The right wing would largely continue the line of the supremacists, arguing that the MRO's uprising failed because it was led by inexperienced teachers instead of by trained military officers. So, the right wing would represent the interests of the Bulgarian government, albeit now more informally, while the left wing would further distance themselves from Bulgaria and adopt a multi-ethnic and socialist ideology. In the 5 years between the Ilinden Uprising and the Young Turk Revolution, both wings of the MRO would continue to organize guerrilla bands in Macedonia. And this rivalry between the two wings of the MRO would become so intense in the coming years that they would just begin assassinating each other and declaring death sentences on rival leaders. And in 1907, Boris Sarafov, who, as we said earlier, had often flitted back and forth between the MRO and the supremacists, would be assassinated by an agent of Jan Sandanski, because Sarafov came to be seen as a traitor and as a right-wing pawn of the Bulgarian government. So, even though the Ilinden Uprising had been brutally suppressed, the Macedonian struggle would really only further intensify following the revolt. And with the Slavic groups now weakened, the Greek and Serbian governments would take the opportunity to further their influence in Macedonia, as they also began to organize guerrilla bands in the region. And in general, the Macedonian struggle would become more vicious during this later period, as the idealism of the MRO, who pushed for solidarity between oppressed ethnic groups, would be replaced by hyper-nationalism, as guerrilla bands would all push the chauvinistic and expansionist aims of their respective nation-states, whether they be Bulgaria, Serbia, or Greece. And some Greek guerrilla bands would even cynically team up with the Ottoman army and help them to crush the MRO. And so, this inter-ethnic violence would begin to lay the groundwork for the First and Second Balkan Wars, during which the Macedonian question would continue to be a central concern and a major source of tension. Now, what is easy to miss in all of this is that even though Bulgaria, Serbia, and Greece were all fighting to gain control of Macedonia, during this time, Macedonia was still under the control of the Ottoman Empire. Macedonia was not even an autonomous province. It was under the direct administration of the Ottomans and remained a central part of the empire. So the generalized chaos of the Macedonian struggle would create even more resentment amongst Muslim military officers in the Third Army of Macedonia, who were given the very unenviable task of trying to maintain order in Macedonia as they fought Christian guerrillas and tried to put an end to all of this violent chaos. And critically, the nature of the Macedonian struggle as a conflict fought between ethnically based nation-states would heighten the sense amongst Muslim officers that they were locked in a Darwinian struggle against these Christian nation-states. And increasingly, this struggle would come to be understood as being fought against Christians more generally. And then, even though the great powers did not intervene militarily on behalf of Christian rebels during the Ilinden Uprising, the great powers would, following the uprising, establish a foreign-led gendarme police force, allegedly in order to help the Ottoman Third Army to maintain order in the Macedonian provinces.
the presence of these smug European officers who immediately began just bossing around Ottoman officers would create even more resentment within the Ottoman Third Army and would begin to spread fear amongst their ranks that the great powers were secretly making plans for a future occupation of the region, as had happened in Bosnia-Herzegovina, Egypt, Cyprus, and so on. This fear that the great powers were planning to occupy and administer Macedonia will end up being the trigger for the mutiny in the Ottoman Third Army that will launch the revolution of 1908. But we are not there just yet, and as we will see next week, the revolutionary chaos that had so far been limited to the Ottoman borderlands of Macedonia and eastern Anatolia since the mid-1890s would finally penetrate Sultan Abdulhamid's inner sanctum, as Armenian revolutionaries wishing to enact their revenge against the Sultan for his role in the Hamidian massacres load a cart full of explosives and smuggle it into the Yildiz Mosque as they try and put it in to the Red Sultan once and for all. So join me next week for the Yildiz assassination.